Hello and welcome to the Hayloft Hour. I am your host, Jordan, otherwise known as Spotted Bay Productions. I have been viewing the world through the ears of a horse since I was 2 years old, and this podcast is my attempt at uncovering the dark side of the equine industry, true crime, scandals, and horror stories that might otherwise stay locked away in the hayloft forever. My purpose is to make these stories well known so that we can make sure they never happen again, and to let others who may find themselves in these situations know that they are not alone. Make sure to join us on social media to follow my daily life with my two horses. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Spotted Bay Productions. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen and share it with your friends. If you have an episode suggestion or a personal story you would like to submit, email it to me at spottedbay@gmail.com or submit it on spottedbay.com, but please leave out the personal info and just leave behind the juicy details. In today's episode, we will be revisiting my pilot episode, which covers the disappearance of Helen Brock, the heiress to the Brock Candy Company. I originally posted this on YouTube, but I've had a lot of requests to get it up as a podcast too, so I wanted to check that off of my list of things to do this week. This was the first episode that I ever researched, and really it was a good introduction to the dark side of the horse industry, as a lot of other cases that I've researched have connected back to parts of this one. This episode does cover topics that may be difficult to hear, including the death of animals and assault. I don't cover any extremely graphic details, but please proceed with caution and feel free to skip ahead or exit the episode if a topic arises about which you are not comfortable listening, and we will catch you in the next one. All information in this podcast has been found online and compiled for your listening pleasure. Inaccuracies or out-of-date information are always a possibility. This is for educational purposes only, and everything is alleged unless proven in court. I do also want to say that it is raining, but not only raining, it is freezing rain coming down outside, so if you can hear that in the background, I do apologize. But hey, maybe it just sets the mood for the story that we're all about to listen to. Let's get into it. In 1977, Helen Brock flew from Chicago to Minneapolis for a routine appointment at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. After she returned from Minnesota, she was planning to head to Florida to spend the rest of the winter there with her lover, Rick Bailey. However, this never happened because when Helen left the Mayo Clinic on February 17, 1977, she would never be seen again. Helen Brock was originally Helen Voorhees from Unionport, Ohio. She was born in 1911 and grew up in a poor family. She was shortly married to her high school sweetheart in 1928, before they quickly divorced in 1932. Through her adult years, she worked at a pottery factory, but eventually wanted more for herself. Helen moved to Florida to work as a hat check girl at a country club in Palm Beach, some say in hopes of finding a millionaire to marry. Helen did just that when she met Frank Brock in 1950. Frank Brock was in a rocky marriage at the time they met and quickly divorced his wife to pursue a relationship with Helen, who he eventually married. Frank Brock, who was quite a bit older than Helen, had complete control of the E&J Brock & Sons Candy Company, which is still around today, with an estate worth millions of dollars. Frank and Helen built a home together in Fisher Island, Florida, but also kept a home in Glenview, Illinois near the candy factory. Frank sold the company in 1966 for $136 million, which would be about $1.1 billion today, and retired with Helen. Frank absolutely showered Helen in gifts and loved to spend time with her. Unfortunately, their romance came to an end upon Frank's death in 1970 after a long battle with illness. Helen was not only heartbroken, but was extremely lonely. Frank and Helen were not very active in the local social scene, and Helen didn't have many friends in the Chicago area. She devoted a lot of her time, as well as money, from the portion of the Brock estate, worth over $160 million in today's money, that was now hers, to animal welfare organizations and causes. In 1973, Helen was at a car wash with one of her beloved cars that Frank had purchased for her, a pink Cadillac, when she met Rick Bailey. Bailey was 20 years younger than Helen and was known for his abilities to sweet talk older, wealthy women. He would often wine and dine them, often professing his love for them and even discussing marriage. His charm worked on Helen and they began a relationship. Rick Bailey was well known in the Chicago horse industry as a horse salesman, and he owned Bailey stables as well as country club stables. His main clientele at these stables were older women that had been widowed or divorced and knew very little about horses. About 1 year after meeting, Helen told Bailey that she was interested in purchasing some horses. Helen had always loved animals, but didn't really know anything about horses. Some said that she mostly did this as an excuse to spend more time with Bailey. Helen would often spoil Bailey with gifts and vacations, and Bailey knew that he had her wrapped around his finger. Bailey began to line up horses for Helen to purchase. Helen had said that she wanted to spend $100,000 on horses, and Rick Bailey, working alongside his brother Paul Bailey, sold her horses worth only a total of $18,000, scamming her out of tens of thousands of dollars. Allegedly, these horses were bound for the glue factory, and Helen lost most of the money she had invested in them. Now, I want to note that bound for the glue factory is in quotes and is apparently exactly what somebody said. That is not at all what I'm insinuating about horses who are not extremely athletic or high-level horses. Helen had been scammed into buying several expensive broodmares, which she later found out were not worth nearly the amount she spent on them. Helen even brought in an outside appraiser who told her she shouldn't even bother investing in training one of the horses Rick and Paul Bailey had convinced her to buy. That same horse had come with a trainer recommendation by Bailey with a quote of $50,000. So immediately you would think that the Baileys were probably in cahoots with this trainer, right? We'll sell this person a horse that's not worth a whole lot, you know, monetarily, get all our money out of it by scamming them for the purchase price, and then when they find out this horse isn't a high performer, we'll say, oh, no problem, this trainer can fix your problem. And they don't know what a trainer costs, so we'll just tell them, oh, yeah, it's $50,000 to have your horse trained. That is an astronomical amount of money for horse training. I can't fathom. It's also interesting to me that Helen, when she wanted to buy horses from Bailey, which obviously she didn't know any better, she wasn't a horse person, it wasn't, oh, I want a horse that is, you know, well-trained that I can ride, or, oh, I want a broodmare so that I can be a part of breeding some babies to do whatever, racing or jumping or whatever it is. She's like, I have $100,000, buy me some horses. If only I had the luxury. So anyhow, even with all of these alleged scams by Bailey, Helen stayed in her relationship. In 1977, Rick Bailey arranged a trip for Helen from Chicago to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota for an extensive physical exam. Helen was to fly out of Chicago on February 9, 1977, and return on February 17, 1977, and was to be picked up by Jack Matlick, her chauffeur, at the airport. Rick Bailey had talked on the phone with Helen on February 16th when she was at the clinic, so this was the day before that she was supposed to leave to come home, and phone records confirmed that Rick Bailey and Helen did indeed actually talk on this day. That same day that they had spoke on the phone, Bailey checked into a hotel in Florida where he was going to meet up with Helen just days after her planned return from Minnesota. This is where the timeline starts to fall apart. Jack Matlick, Helen's chauffeur, who she referred to as her houseman, claims to have picked Helen up from the Chicago O'Hare Airport and taken her home. Jack has told different stories, though. The first is that Helen came home and she and Jack did not leave the house for the 4 days leading up to her flight to Florida to meet up with Bailey. He also then said that Helen had gone to dinner with friends on some of these nights, but couldn't name with whom she had gone to dinner or where she had gone. No witnesses ever came forward to say that they had either dined with her or seen her out dining. During this 4-day window between her trips, Rick Bailey attempted to reach Helen multiple times by calling her home, but was told that she wasn't available. Another witness came forward stating that they had called the house during this time frame as well, but Jack told them that Helen had actually already left for Florida. 2 weeks after Helen was supposedly picked up from the airport by Jack, he attempted to report her missing. He was told by authorities that a family member had to make the report, so Jack got a hold of Helen's brother, Charles Voorhees. Charles could not fly in immediately, but did eventually come and make the report. When the investigation started, the flight crew on Helen's return flight home was questioned, and none of them ever remembered seeing Helen on the flight from Minneapolis to Chicago. Investigators then started interviewing witnesses at the Mayo Clinic to try to figure out if she even ever left Minnesota alive. A shop assistant had sold Helen makeup on the day of her planned departure, and Helen told the assistant that she needed to hurry because her houseman was waiting on her. This may have been the last person to see Helen alive. So isn't it weird that Helen, who was in, she was at the Mayo Clinic, which is in Rochester, Minnesota, so this would be before she was supposed to fly home, told someone at a makeup counter that her houseman was waiting on her. So to me, that sounds like my houseman is here waiting on me. Because if you needed to catch a flight, you would say that. You would say, I need to hurry and catch my flight, not that your houseman was waiting on you. So did her houseman come all the way to Minnesota to pick her up? And if so, why? Why didn't she just take her flight home? It's all really bizarre. And I also wondered too, and maybe this was just the way things were in the 70s, was there not a manifest from the flight where they would have known exactly who was on the plane? I don't know. Investigators went back to questioning Jack Matlick, who also insisted that he had dropped Helen off for her flight to Florida as expected, although there was no record of Helen ever having planned or purchased tickets for a trip to Florida. He also stated that he had dropped Helen off at 6 a.m. for her flight. However, the first flight to Florida wasn't until 9 a.m., and Helen was said to not be a morning person. Now, remember, Helen is a multimillionaire. She can fly at whatever time of the day she wants. Now, for me, I will take whatever flight of the day is cheapest. And I'm a, I don't say anxious flyer, well-prepared flyer. I like to be at the airport early. But 3 hours before your flight, that's pretty early, especially in the morning. Jack profusely proclaimed his innocence, telling police he had no idea where Helen was. One lead that was followed about Jack was a witness claiming that Jack had made several phone calls to local department stores and he ended up buying a large meat grinder, but police dismissed this as not being relevant to the case. And we're talking, he made several inquiries about industrial-sized meat grinders. He wasn't trying to, you know, grind up some beef to make burgers for himself and his wife. These were big machines. But the cops were like, yeah, no, he just really likes his burgers, you know? Kind of weird. More evidence came forward showing that around the time of Helen's disappearance, Jack had the mansion deep cleaned. This was beyond Windex and Lysol. There was repainting and recarpeting done, and one of Helen's cars had to be deep cleaned and detailed. Around this time, Jack was also caught forging several checks totaling $13,000 that were written to himself from Helen's accounts. He also failed a lie detector test twice when asked if he knew where Helen was and was rumored to have started stealing Helen's jewelry after she disappeared. Jack's wife got a different story from him, however, and said that Jack told her that Helen had never returned from the Mayo Clinic. The weekend of Helen's disappearance, Jack had called his wife and told her that he would be staying at Helen's for the weekend because he had work to do. What work did you have to do, Jack? After Frank died, Jack was possibly the closest man Helen had in her life. It was rumored that Jack even kept a lock of Helen's hair in a box next to his bed. Helen had also written Jack into the will, leaving him $50,000 if she died. Shortly after Helen's disappearance, attorney John Cadwallader Mink was appointed as guardian for Helen's estate and got much more than he bargained for. When he searched her house to look for a will or anything else pertaining to her estate, he found, in plain sight, a suitcase with a baggage tag from Minneapolis to Chicago. This suitcase had not been found in the two previous searches of the home done by local police, and quite possibly the weirdest and most damning piece of evidence, in my opinion, was that Charles Voorhees, Helen's brother, and Jack, the chauffeur, admitted to burning all of Helen's journals, letters, and other writings only days after she went missing. They stated that they did this because Helen had left a note saying that if anything happened to her, to burn these because she wouldn't want anyone seeing them. How would they know only after a few days that something had happened to her? And how weird is it that that would be a note that she would leave behind? What were in those writings that she didn't want anyone to see? Finally, police did find a toll receipt dated for February 21st, the day that Jack supposedly took Helen to the airport to leave for Florida. The toll receipt was for the exit near a farm in rural Ohio owned by Helen. However, none of this evidence could lead to any sort of arrest or trial, especially because they still didn't know for sure that Helen was dead. They didn't have a body. And in Illinois, someone has to be missing for 7 years before they can be declared legally dead. So the case went cold for 2 years. The case lay cold until 1979, when a message was written in red spray paint near Helen's house claiming that Rick Bailey was responsible for Helen's disappearance and knew where she was. This reinvigorated the entire case with a new suspect, Helen's lover. Bailey was subpoenaed and questioned in 1979, and when asked if he knew Helen, not even if he knew where she was or what happened to her, just if he knew her, he pled the Fifth. Pleading the Fifth Amendment, in case you don't know, is something you can do in the U.S. because you have the constitutional right to not be compelled by the government to incriminate yourself or otherwise the right to remain silent. This is probably a thing in other countries, but I don't know that it's called the same thing, so I just wanted to clarify if you're not from the U.S. As I said before, Bailey was known for swindling wealthy women out of their money with the promise of love and romance and using horses as a vehicle to do it. He was even referred to as the Galloping Gigolo. Bailey said that there was nothing to the spray-painted messages and that they were probably done by someone else in the horse industry who was just jealous of his success. His shady reputation alone, however, wasn't enough evidence to arrest him or put him on trial, so the case once again went cold. In 1984, 7 years after her disappearance, Helen Brock was legally declared dead. Everett Moore, the accountant working on the estate, pushed to have Helen's legal date of death declared as early as possible to avoid additional taxes on the account. This was also pushed by Charles Voorhees, Helen's brother, because this would mean that he would be able to collect the interest that had been growing on the $500,000 trust fund left to him by his sister. Having the death date declared as early as possible would also reduce federal taxes that had been mounting on the estate. The estate had also paid out nearly $1 million over that time to maintain Helen's homes and her horses. However, Jack did not receive his $50,000. He signed an agreement to forgo that money left to him in exchange for no charges being brought against him for check forgery and theft. The majority of the rest of Helen's estate went to her Animal Welfare Foundation. The case stayed cold until 1989, 12 years after Helen's disappearance. A woman named Barbara Morris made a report to the FBI about Rick Bailey for fraud. She had also been scammed out of her money by this notorious horse flipper. This time, Steve Miller was on the case. Miller immediately made the connection to Helen's case and instead prosecuted this entire thing as a financial case and not a murder investigation, hoping that would prove more successful. Miller was right and ended up uncovering another layer to this entire sinister situation. Murdering horses for money. Bailey was said to have picked up using horses as a method to scam rich people out of their money because horses were easy to lie about, especially to wealthy people who didn't know the first thing about a good horse. It was also discovered that Bailey would take out misleading personal ads in the local papers, making himself out to be a wealthy man looking for love in order to lure rich, lonely women into his trap. And if all that wasn't bad enough, Rick Bailey's shady business practices went one step farther. Criminal activity. Rick Bailey, along with several accomplices, were found to have been killing underperforming horses that had large insurance policies taken out on them in order to obtain the insurance money and purchase more horses. Bailey got himself into this crime ring when he himself was scammed by another shady horseman, Silas Jane. And let me tell you, Silas Jane makes Rick Bailey look like a saint. Imagine getting scammed or like having something bad happening to you, and instead of sitting back and saying, wow, that really sucks that people are like that, I would never do that to someone, you're like, well, dang, I got scammed, but that good one, like that's like stealing a joke from somebody at a bar. You're like, that was a good one, I'm gonna use that. But instead it's, you know, scamming people for money. Silas Jane lived in Chicago and had ownership over several stables. He had an extensive criminal history, including committing rape as a teenager, murdering his half-brother, for which he only served a 7-year sentence, and being connected to the murder of 3 young boys. It was also found later that 3 witnesses to a car bombing meant for his half-brother that ended up killing a young woman instead also went missing. And now, of course, he became a suspect in the disappearance of Helen Brock. Silas was in prison at the time of Helen's disappearance, but was thought to be connected to soliciting her murder. Helen had discovered the absolutely disgusting things that Silas, Bailey, and others were doing to horses in exchange for insurance money, and they found out that she was planning to talk. In addition to killing horses for money, Silas also used some of his stables as fronts for other illicit businesses and, like Bailey, would obtain relatively worthless horses and sell them for extremely inflated prices to unsuspecting wealthy folks with promises of making them or their children champions. Silas Jane was also known to be so dangerous and so violent that he would demand a percentage of proceeds from local horse shows, and they would give it to him out of fear. The Janes were often referred to as the Horse Mafia in Chicago. Jane worked closely with another man, Tom Burns, who was known as the Sandman because he, quote, puts horses to sleep. Gag. Burns would be called in whenever a person had an expensive horse that was underperforming and needed to disappear. The methods they used to kill horses make me actually want to vomit, and I had to stop reading about it. I'm not going to talk about them here either. If you're that curious, you can Google it for yourself, but I'm telling you, it's horrid. There's pictures and descriptions. You don't want to see it. A more famous or infamous incident of this case was when Burns was hired to kill the horse of Olympic hopeful and heir to a massive family fortune, George Lindemann, because the horse made him look bad. And rather than admit he couldn't handle the horse, he hired Burns to kill the horse so that he could collect from its insurance policy. So considering the company that Silas keeps, it's not a surprise to hear that he's a suspect in Helen's disappearance after she had been heard saying that she was going to go to the authorities about this disgusting horse abuse. Learning about this connection gave Miller the needed fuel to look further into the case. Silas's involvement in Helen's disappearance was almost corroborated by Maurice Ferguson when in 1989 he told police that he knew where Helen's body was because he himself had buried it. Ferguson was cellmates with Silas but was paroled in 1979. Ferguson told police that Silas had asked him to go collect the remains of the Candy Lady from one of his stables near Chicago and go bury them elsewhere. Ferguson said that he agreed and that he took the remains to Minneapolis, which was a strange coincidence considering Minnesota was the last place where Helen was seen. Ferguson said that he chose this location because his sister lived there. Can you imagine your brother comes to visit you and you find out that he also just happened to be burying a body in the area and decided to drop by for some tea? Gross. Anyway, this was not the first time Ferguson had done this with police. It was actually his third time. But this time he told police he wasn't lying, because at this point Silas was dead and he wasn't afraid of him anymore. So Ferguson led police to a field near Minneapolis, where heavy equipment was used to try to dig up Helen's body. But to no avail. Her body wasn't there. Helen's brother told investigators that he knew Ferguson had nothing to do with Helen's disappearance and believed he was only after the $250,000 reward for Helen dead or alive put up by Helen's estate. Helen's brother reiterated that Jack had to be the guilty party. So while Silas Jane's involvement was not completely corroborated by Maurice Ferguson's story, he was still charged, along with over 20 others, for crimes including killing horses for insurance money, racketeering, and more. It is believed that between 50 and 100 horses had been killed between the 1970s to 1990s until this investigation stopped it. One of the others charged in this case was Rick Bailey, and his charges included conspiracy to commit murder because of his previous links to Helen Brock's murder. During hearings for his crimes, Rick Bailey's attorneys told him to plead guilty to some of the lesser crimes, such as racketeering, in hopes of avoiding a trial by jury for crimes linked to the disappearance of Helen Brock. Bailey's attorneys thought this would give him a better chance at being acquitted of the more severe crimes, since the emotions of a jury wouldn't be involved. However, the opposite happened. When a jury trial is waived, the court no longer has to prove that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Instead, a judge only has to find that a preponderance of evidence indicates that Bailey was involved. In 1995, Bailey was indicted by a grand jury on his charges. While he was not technically convicted on the charges associated with conspiring to murder Helen, the judge commented that the sentencing reflected the evidence that Bailey had done so. Because this was a federal sentencing hearing, the judge was allowed to account for all relevant conduct in this sentence. There still stands an issue with Bailey's indictment, however. The key witness, Joe Plemons, a known con man turned federal informant, made a deal with Miller to tell everything he knew and what happened to Helen in exchange for immunity. Not only did he say he knew what happened to her, he said he was there. Plemons testified that Bailey had solicited him to kill Helen for $5,000 because she had planned to come forward with what she knew about Bailey and the others. This alleged eyewitness to the entire case finally gave Miller the motive he was looking for Helen's murder. While investigators were cautious to believe Plemons because it had now been almost 30 years since Helen's disappearance, they listened to his story as he gave every excruciating detail. Plemons said that on the night of Helen's disappearance, he received a call from another man in this shady criminal ring, Ken Hansen. Plemons knew what kind of man Hansen was, and when Hansen said he needed Plemons to come meet him, Plemons didn't ask any questions. Plemons arrived at one of Hansen's stables sometimes after 1 a.m., and the two of them waited for a while. Eventually, a Cadillac pulled into one of the riding arenas at Hansen's farm and parked next to a station wagon. The two men walked over to the Cadillac, and the trunk opened to reveal Helen's body, which was battered, bloody, and wrapped in a blanket. Plemons recalled that he thought immediately that Helen was dead. Hansen motioned for Plemons to help him, so they picked up Helen's body to move her to the station wagon. As they began to walk, Helen began to moan, and both men dropped her into the arena dirt. At this moment, Kurt Hansen, Ken's brother, pulled out two guns. He handed one to Plemons. Before Plemons knew it, the other gun was pointed at his chest. "Kill or be killed," said Kurt. Plemons was told to put holes through that blanket or there will be two of you in the station wagon. Plemons did as he was told. At this point, he made sure to clarify that he thought Helen was already dead. He reiterated that he knew he had to shoot or be shot, and so he did what he had to do to save his own life. After this, Helen's body was loaded into the station wagon, and the group of men took her body to a nearby steel mill where her body was incinerated in the furnace. Unfortunately, Kurt Hansen died in 1993, so he could not testify on this allegation. Ken Hansen was imprisoned around this time for a different murder, however, his lawyers insist he had nothing to do with Helen Brock's murder. Investigators were satisfied with this story and decided to prosecute, however, Plemons now stated that another man, not Rick Bailey, was responsible for ordering Helen's murder. That man is already in prison for a different crime, and his lawyers also insist he was not involved in Helen's case. Some sources say that Plemons also said Silas Jane was the one who put out the hit on Helen. Along with this allegation in 2004, Plemons' story changed to say that 10 people, including a police officer, beat and shot Helen to death. He added that one of the women involved had impersonated Helen and taken her plane ride home from Minnesota, and that Helen had actually been driven home. Several contradictory reports have been given by Plemons, including one in which Jack was the guilty party. One of the only pieces of physical evidence brought forward by Plemons is a ruby ring that he says he kept from Helen's body before she was incinerated. Family and friends did confirm that this ring was Helen's, but no DNA or other more solid evidence has been able to confirm it. Silas died in 1987, Hansen died in 2007, Jack died in 2011, still maintaining his innocence, and Plemons died in 2016 of cancer. It's interesting hearing Plemons' version of events because they don't really make sense. I mean, if you were going to off someone who was going to expose what you were doing to horses, why would you call in someone random to come move a body from one car to the other and then shoot the person? Do you know what I mean? That doesn't make logical sense, unless you just wanted everybody to be a little bit guilty so that nobody would tell on you. But they could have just not called Plemons at all and he would have had no idea. So the whole thing just seems like it was really a shot in the dark for whatever Plemons was saying. And I don't even know why he came forward with this story if it wasn't true. It's all weird. In 2005, Bailey requested a new sentencing hearing because of this Plemons testimony, saying that it proved his innocence and he had more than served his time for the fraud charges. Bailey believed that he was now serving time for crimes that no evidence proved he committed. The court ruled against him, saying that it would make more sense to overturn his conviction rather than reduce his sentence, but regardless, that it didn't prove that he wasn't complicit in Helen's murder, the crime for which he was imprisoned. Plemons also allegedly recanted his entire statement about Helen's murder in 2005. Bailey's attorneys attempted to request presidential clemency, a pardon from a conviction of a federal offense, and an argument to the Supreme Court about his case due to serving time for a crime which had a lack of evidence. Rick Bailey was released from prison in 2017. So here we are, 35 years later, still with no answers as to what happened to Helen Brock. A marble monument marks an empty tomb with Helen's name on it, next to a family gravesite that includes Helen's parents, husband, and two of her beloved dogs, Candy and Sugar. The home that had belonged to the Brock estate recently went up for sale in 2017, listed for just under $2 million. What I want to know is, why did they let Jack go? Why did no one suspect him? Was Jack actually involved in the horse mafia, and the mafia was powerful enough to keep him out of prison and let Bailey take the fall instead? Was this just a case of police incompetence? There are deeper conspiracy theories that believe Helen took off to start a new life, but what millionaire would take off without any money? And probably even more important to Helen, she was a serious animal lover, so why would she leave her 12 dogs behind with Jack? And one of the wildest rumors that still floats around today is that Jack did indeed kill Helen and then disposed of her body using the infamous meat grinder purchased from the department store and fed her to her dogs. So, what would you do if you found out your significant other was murdering horses for insurance money? You'd probably go to the police, right? Or some sort of authority. Would you expect that your partner would then turn around and kill you because you were going to talk? I don't know. And I don't know anybody in this case, so to me, I could see how people would want to silence her if she was going to go to the police about this. I can also see motive for Jack to do it, but Jack seemed like he had the most evidence against him, whereas everybody else, it was kind of, not circumstantial is probably not the right word, but there was nothing concrete other than Plemons' testimony, basically. It is a little bit weird that Plemons had the ring, but I don't know how to explain that. And if Jack was, like, in cahoots with everyone, it said that Jack stole some of Helen's jewelry, so maybe it somehow got to Plemons that way, or he just had one that looked like one that she wore. I don't know. It's a giant mess. But that is all we have for this case. There are a few books out there about this case, and I believe a couple documentaries if you're interested in diving deeper into it. But I also know that while this case and things tangential to it didn't necessarily stop the killing of horses for insurance money, I think it did bring it to light. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we probably saw less of that happening after this, either because insurance companies wised up because they went, oh wow, like this is more common than we thought, or people just got better at hiding it or finding other ways to get money for their underperforming horses. So who knows, but that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for being here. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe and follow us everywhere else on social media. We're at Spotted Bay Productions on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and we will look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks for being here.